Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
It's another movie night with Project Nerd, and as you can tell from the intro music, this one's all about Stanley Kubrick. Actually, you could probably tell from the title, because I'm assuming you read it before you got in here, but I do have some more guests with us. Of course, this is your host, Iggy, and I do have another Nerdcast regular, or I don't know if regular, you guys are part of the show, but Adam.
Yeah, regular.
And then, of course, the other half of Adam, the original power couple of Manhattan, Kansas here. Laura.
That's our friend knows. Friends know us as the power couple.
They are the power couple. Yeah, I mean, so Adam and Laura. And Bob is still present in the room. I say still because even though this is probably a week later from the last time you heard us, it is right after we just recorded the last episode. And since we are talking movies, I have this deep feeling that you might hear from Bob a little bit tonight. So he might chime in on some things. But just like we introduced last time, this is the movie night with Project Nerd, and we're not enjoying popcorn, but I'm going to say we are as we talk all things Stanley Kubrick tonight. Mm-hmm. So right out the gate, let's go around. Favorite Stanley Kubrick movie, Laura?
Oh God.
You can only pick one.
Only one?
You're not the boss of me.
All right. So my gut reaction.
That's what I'm going with here. What's your gut reaction?
Eyes Wide Shut.
Really?
Wow.
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
That was the not expecting that. Adam didn't even expect that.
Bombshell.
Nope. Adam was expecting, I guarantee it, The Shining.
I was expecting that.
I was
All right.
expecting The Shining. Yeah.
Adam, it's amazing.
Adam, your favorite, the Kubrick?
Gut reaction is probably 2001, but I really want that answer to be Full Metal Jacket.
Okay. Gut reaction here, Dr. Strangelove.
Nice.
Oh,
we all picked different ones
I know.
Without
so,
planning it. That's
so,
cool.
Laura, Eyes Wide Shut. Why Eyes Wide Shut?
Yeah. Defend yourself, woman.
Yeah, why are you guys surprised with
I'm
this?
Not,
I mean, it's
I'm
amazing.
Not asking you to defend yourself. I'm just saying now we have to talk about Stanley Kubrick for 40 minutes or so. So why Eyes Wide Shut?
Why Eyes Wide Shut? So I would say that Eyes Wide Shut is one of those movies that makes me feel like a different person when I'm finished watching it.
Like a perv?
More than that, though. More than that.
More than a perv.
I am a perv, but more than that. I don't know. It was a transformative experience watching that film.
Was that your first Kubrick?
Yes.
Oh, the look on her face when she answered
that
too was regret.
It was. It was my first Stanley Kubrick film. And it changed. I feel like something changed about me as a result of watching that film.
You realize there were good movies out there.
Well, that probably.
Or you realize there's giant high class orgies.
Yeah. I think we all knew that beforehand.
Did we? Did we, Adam? I'm sorry, I'm not part of the power couple here for a minute.
We know about all the sex parties.
It's crazy because it just like any other Kubrick movie, I mean it is a really well done movie.
Yep.
But because it crosses a lot more boundaries than any other Kubrick movie did before that, it caught a lot more flack. It caught a lot of crap. Not just from audiences, but from studios too. There was they had to digitally put in people to block sex for the theatrical release.
Really?
Yeah. So depending on what version you saw, if you saw, I think they call it his director's cut or just the final cut, whatever they refer to it as.
Yeah.
As opposed to theatrical release of it, they had to go back and digitally put people in those scenes to block certain things so that it could be released theatrically.
Yeah.
Because that's before there was that weird 2 or 3 year period where studios did experiment with releasing NC-17 in theaters,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that was before that. And now we're at the after that, cause obviously it did not succeed. But to get it down to that R rating. So little tidbit that you may not have known,
nice.
But,
RS... Well, and you need that R rating if you want to make any money.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Really, like the NC-17 rating, even if you can get people to release your film, nobody's going to come and see it.
Mm-hmm.
Not a broad audience, at least.
Which is a whole nother awkward, strange conversation about, you know, violence and how easy it is to get an R rating with violence and how awkward it is to get an R rating with explicit sexual content and nudity.
That might make a great episode.
Hey.
So it was your first one.
Yep, it was my first
powerful movie.
One.
Really transformed the way you looked at group sex. Now,
That's true.
So, Adam, you made her defend herself on that one. So, 2001, why is that your gut reaction favorite Kubrick movie?
I mean, it's going to be the visuals. And clearly from the music in the intro, like, the way that it all ties in there. I mean, you watch that movie and it's... I remember sitting there going... Somebody gonna talk in this? Am I watching this? It's like a half hour before
three different movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a half hour before anybody says anything in that film. And I just remember same kind of thing. I don't think it was the first Kubrick that I saw. I think Full Metal Jacket was, and I think that's why I want that to be my answer because it's got that place in my heart. But
or is it because you can suck a golf ball through a garden hose?
Power couple, Iggy. Power couple. Yeah. But no, so I think watching 2001, it is everything a movie I think should be. It incorporates, the music ties in really, really well. It's beautifully, beautifully, beautifully shot. The fact that movie came out in like 67 or 68.
That's
wild. The effects hold up to this day.
Yes.
Not to like 20 years ago, but right now you can put that movie in and it looks
beautiful.
Phenomenal.
Totally beautiful.
To the, not only the effects to this day, we talked a little useless trivia in regards to Eyes Wide Shut, but some trivia there. The rotating spacecraft. Now, I know it wasn't completely Kubrick's ideas. There have been some other sci-fi writers who conceived that and stuff.
Right.
But Kubrick was the first person to put that on screen or really put that into practice somewhere, I guess, the way to create artificial gravity by rotating a ship, which is actually now... something that is still being explored by the private companies and governments in regards to space travel and creating artificial gravity. So revolutionizing as well. Great topic right there too, because Bob and I discussed favorite movies on the first episode. And I talked so much about The Matrix and how it revolutionized sci-fi at that point in time. Mm-hmm. I can go back and, obviously not same amount of years, but you go back generations of films and you look at things that revolutionize cinema in the sci-fi genre, which it's totally there. And there's some, you could make an early 90s argument for some stuff regarding Alien and Terminator and all that late that kind of time period, but really you go back, there was The Matrix that's changed everything and we're still living in the Matrix era.
Yes.
Right.
The era before that was Blade Runner.
Yep.
There was the Blade Runner era, and the era before that was 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Totally.
So it set a tone for sci-fi movies until something finally came along and revolutionized and changed the game again. But exactly that. And the best thing about it is when you look at what the Wachowskis do compared to The Matrix. And I love The Matrix. We were just talking before we started recording, Cloud Atlas, things like that. Great. But they're not, like, you look at 2001 compared to the rest of Kubrick's works.
Right.
Nothing similar in there. Like, it's nothing. And actually, you can say that almost about any movie he's done, even as far as his big hit, the one he took over midstream, Spartacus. Like, nothing else that he had done.
No two works from Kubrick are similar in any way.
Other than they're all completely phenomenal.
Right. Yes. They're all incredible.
Great point. So mine, Dr. Strangelove, or... I always butcher the subtitle. Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
I think so.
That's it.
Bob, fact check for me. Yeah, all right. He gave me a thumbs up. Just phenomenal. Well, first of all, Peter Sellers.
Such a good movie.
Like, as, three different characters
in that movie.
There is, as a younger, seeing that younger, so there was a few Kubricks I saw younger that I didn't get in trouble for seeing in 2001 would have been one of them.
Nothing bad in Strangelove either.
Dr. Strangelove was another one. I did see a few other ones that could have pushed some boundaries. Lolita, we won't mention that, but I still don't think my mom knows that I saw it as early as I did.
She does now.
I remember being a kid and just watching Peter Sellers in the wheelchair with his arm going out of control and trying to grab it down or something. Or the cowboy riding The bomb off
yep.
the plane.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Just no fighting in the war room. Like
so
all
funny.
That.
Yes.
Gentlemen,
so
you can't
funny.
Fight in here. This
it's
is the war room.
So, so Bob, I need to get your perspective, though. If you can throw it out, we'll say it for you on the microphone. What's your favorite Kubrick movie?
Mm-hmm. I tell you, I love The Shining.
Mm-hmm. So is that your gut-filling one, though? For everybody who can't hear or listening in anticipation.
Bob said The Shining.
It's hard.
Adding imaginary drum roll. Barry Lyndon, one that we hadn't talked about yet.
And the one film that he was starting to do before he died.
AI. See, AI,
oh,
I think,
yeah.
is... AI,
oh,
so The Shining, I'm going to give you The Shining on that one, because that was your gut one.
Yeah.
Yep, it's
that was
the
first
Shining.
One you said. Barry Lyndon, phenomenal. Once you go, talk about nothing similar, because
totally
that's a Western.
Different.
That's
yep.
a Western movie. He doesn't have another one in there. AI, like, I feel like it. I wish you would have been there to
right,
see it through.
I'm really intrigued to see what that movie would have looked like.
Because Spielberg put his own touch on it.
Right,
yep.
Yeah.
Spielberg put his own touch on it, and I feel their two tones, although I like Spielberg's filmmaking, even though I sit here and try to pretend like I don't, because everybody wants to hate Spielberg and Lucas, but
you
everybody
can't.
Knows
no,
we
don't.
Love their entire
no,
libraries.
Yes, we do.
And we just get tired of them, but they're like rehashing their stuff and butchering. But no Indiana Jones in the fridge. But anyways... The two tones just don't fit together.
No.
Kubrick's
no.
tone and Spielberg's tone.
It didn't
and I
turn
think
out well.
That hurts AI, in my
yep.
opinion. I know a lot of people love that movie. My wife's a big fan of it as well. You know, Bob's speaking highly of it. But I think it's not that it's terrible. It's just those two tones. You can feel those two tones tugging at each other throughout the movie, I guess. The way.
Yeah, it made it fall flat for me.
Colliding.
Okay. Bob yeah. said not tugging, colliding. That's probably a better way to put it. So... talking about favorites, but we talked a little bit about Kubrick. The amazing things about him, you know, just how long his career spanned over that with such powerful movies all
yeah.
through it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
But also talking about that different style. So we talked a little bit about, you know, the comedy, the over-the-top political comedy, too, because mm-hmm. there was definitely some mm-hmm. tearing down of the politics in Dr. Strangelove.
Definitely.
To the sci-fi movie that sets a tone, that sets a... two decades plus
right, 20 years yeah.
of the way sci-fi is made to a Western movie that is very well praised but still underrated, I think, Barry Lyndon, mm-hmm. to Lolita, which is just one of those, I mean, you talk about just a, you want to talk about a Eyes Wide Shut level of just inappropriate maybe at some points, but
mm-hmm.
yeah.
All right, so we were talking about the inappropriates of Lolita. And there mm-hmm. might be some weird editing right in here just because we had battery issues. mm-hmm. But we were heading that direction of, you know, Spartacus got brought up briefly, but the one that we're talking about, Full Metal Jacket, horror genre. Oh. So then we hit the horror
yep.
film. And not just a, not a typical horror movie. Like, it's a
no.
intense, like, gut-wrenching, like, exhausting, I guess is probably a good way to explain it, with The Shining. And then, like you said, you go into Eyes Wide Shut, which is just a whole new world for him as a filmmaker.
Yep.
And something that pushes boundaries, not typically pushed, especially at that time period.
Right.
You know, so, and we're just naming some of those movies that you think of right off the top. And there's always those one or two for Stanley Kubrick that you forget. And I just pulled it up and I can't believe we forgot it. A Clockwork Orange.
Oh!
Like,
how have we not talked
yeah, I know.
About
so,
A Clockwork
I mean,
Orange? Talk about movies that will change the way that you think about movies.
I know.
Yeah. And pushing
Clockwork
envelopes.
Orange. Oh, yeah. It pushed envelopes. Well, there were so many things that were more scandalous in A Clockwork Orange, I feel, than Eyes Wide Shut.
Right.
Like, particularly the sexual violence, the violence in general. A lot more gut-wrenching content. In A Clockwork Orange.
Right. You get a lot of that from the source material, the Burgess novel.
Yep.
Very, very dark. And really lets Kubrick go there. I think the thing to me that stands out about a lot of his movies and all the ones that we've mentioned for sure is the pacing. The way he's willing to let something just kind of stew for 3/5 of the movie.
To make you almost uncomfortable.
Right. Then all of a sudden it pops up and you're like, oh, why did he leave this for so long? And there's so many of those little things throughout the movie that you're just like, this is going to come to a head. I don't know how. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm uncomfortable with this, but it's going to get there.
Yep. And the timing is amazing. I mean, he's almost like a musician, like a jazz musician in the way that he makes films. Because, really, you can play with time when you are making a film. and change the experience of the film entirely. And he does that really beautifully and makes his audience feel uncomfortable in the most magnificent way. I love it.
Yeah. Well, it's engaging. You're not just a passive spectator to the movie, which you are in so many popular movies, but you're a complete participant because of how uncomfortable the movie's making you or how engaging you're finding the visual effects or the way the score is interacting yeah. with it. I mean, you have to participate in the movie, and that just adds a whole level of depth, I think, that a lot of films miss out on.
Yeah, it's an incredibly intimate experience, which is, I think, why people are so split on A Clockwork Orange, probably. I mean, I talk to people about A Clockwork Orange, and it's either that they really love it or they totally hate it and find it disgusting. And I think it's because of how intimate it is that you can't watch that movie without taking a little ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And that can make people feel profoundly uncomfortable.
So in the Congressional Library keeps movies that define cinema, you know, and stuff like that. And they pull them in. Congressional Library. Yeah, I'm right.
Right.
They pull them in and one that is often, some things that are often forgotten about Stanley Kubrick is his first full length feature is a part of that. And that's something not a lot of directors can say, because your first full length feature, not typically like that. And it's something that not a lot of people mm-hmm. have seen. It's Fear and Desire. So we talk about, Full Metal Jacket, war movies. So he did a number of war movies, actually, you know, Paths of Glory, Fear and Desire, that, yep. but they're all so different. But it's crazy that his first movie that's not widely seen, not widely praised, that led to so many things, it has all those traits that he does put into all his other movies, those long, intense moments, that just feeling, yeah. and Bob and I discussed it, that when you're picking your favorite movies, you pick something that evokes emotion, and there's not a Stanley Kubrick film that doesn't.
No.
Whether it's an emotion you want to pop up right then or not, it doesn't matter. There's something that's going to happen, when you're watching his films. But he has a number of great movies from the beginning to the end. Like, I don't think there's a bad movie in his library. And,
no.
And as I'm thinking more and more about other directors, there's other directors that I want to compare to him, same like that. And there's probably another director or two out there that I could say the same as. And there's a couple directors that I love everything they've done, but have a couple where I'm like, eh. But there's mm-hmm. not even an eh with Stanley Kubrick.
No.
No.
And I'm thinking Scorsese. But, you know, then you go to Shutter Island or something like that, and you're like, eh. And then you're thinking Wes Anderson. But in the fact that I'm even including him in a conversation with Kubrick's kind of, I know my wife would be okay
kinda,
with that, but I'm
kind of. Kind of weird.
But even
but
so.
But if you look at the breadth of work from one to the other, yes, Wes Anderson movies are all good, but they're not.
But not even that. Bottle Rocket doesn't hold a candle to a single Kubrick movie. You know, the majority of Andersons don't. And then I'll even go to Tarantino, but then there's enough, I think, weakness in a couple of his films to not even mm-hmm. up there, but he would probably be the closest to where I can say every body of work he's done. No, but then even, you know, there's that Grindhouse feature after watching it that I know a lot of people love that. I'm kind of,
it grows on you, I think. The closest one to me, or for me, would be probably like Darren Aronofsky.
Oh, totally.
But that's what, four movies?
Hey, well, I mean, you gotta start somewhere, incredible. Man. I mean,
it's true. I mean,
well, and there are a lot of similarities, I think, between Aronofsky and Kubrick. And in terms of how uncomfortable and emotionally intense they are, all of them, and all of them different and unique in Aronofsky's playbook. Well, all totally different and unique.
Aronofsky's very open about Kubrick being a big inspiration mm-hmm. for his filmmaking mm-hmm. as well.
Makes sense.
Definitely makes sense. And in fact, almost all these directors we just named, every director we've named has named, notably enough to where I can even just remember it off the top of my head. I've heard Wes Anderson interviews where he's even mentioned Kubrick.
Yeah.
Scorsese loved Kubrick. They were good. They became good friends.
Mm-hmm.
They were huge into the restoration of film together. Tarantino talks about Kubrick frequently. I mean, these are directors that we talk about that are doing great bodies of work, not just one single movie.
Right.
But they all go back to him, you know, as that inspiration, as that starting point.
Yeah.
A couple of facts I like to point out about Kubrick that I always love. The one was, of course, that he always called himself stupid. felt he had a very low IQ.
Mm-hmm.
The rumor definitely was that it was up around 200, though.
Yeah, I think
so,
it was.
Like, somewhere around that.
That's the accepted IQ range for him, yeah.
The other thing is, though, that he did struggle in school, and that's why he, you know, called himself stupid. He was very struggling in school, but he went at that time where school, you know, the importance of school wasn't there.
Yep.
He definitely had to do work while he was during
this time. Well, yeah, and it was still rote memorization when he was going to school, which if your IQ is 200... is the most boring thing you could ever do. I mean,
Well, and there's tons of research right now looking at the connection between different learning disabilities, things that are now classified as learning disabilities, like dyslexia and creativity and creative output. So people that are learning disabled actually have an advantage in terms of creativity, particularly people with dyslexia, because they see the world in ways that we don't
and we could never imagine.
Exactly. That makes them incredible creative minds, but they don't really fit well into the box of public schooling.
So with all that, he never went to college, never went to university and all that. However, he did, I can't say he never went. He was never enrolled. He did attend film classes at Columbia University. He sat in on the classes.
Oh, my God.
To learn that. And then, of course, if I remember correctly, he made some short films. I believe he was introduced into the industry. I'd have to look it up to be sure because I can't remember this. So don't quote me on this, although I'm being recorded right now. I believe, you know, he was entered. He was just kind of finding ways to get into the industry because he loved film so much and found some ways in there and then finally made his first full-length feature, which... Fear and Desire and just blew him away. And then there's The Killing. And then was it Killer's Kiss? Is that the other one that is on The Killing? So if you get The Killing Criterion Pack either on DVD or Blu-ray, it has Killer's Kiss, which was never released on VHS, DVD, like as its own movie. But that was another early feature length one. And then he did Paths of Glory, which really started to elevate himself and become more known. And big part of that is because he got to work with Kirk Douglas. And Kirk Douglas was really, really good in Paths of Glory. And Kirk Douglas is also a big reason why he ended up taking over Spartacus.
Yeah, Spartacus, right.
Yep.
Which I love talking about that because you want to talk about a movie that turned out amazing that had disaster written all over it from the beginning.
Totally.
So we talk about movies like World War Z, the second G.I. Joe, all these things that Gangster Squad, these are just in the past couple years that got so far and then just got pushed out.
And
had
rewrite.
New people. You know, we're
total
worrying about
disasters.
Second director.
We're worrying about Ant-Man. Before it even got into production, it's in pre-production. Before it ever got in pre-production, because the director switches, when Marvel has given us a pretty good building block to say we should be able to trust them on it, but we're still sitting here worried about it.
Yep.
Now let's talk about that with Spartacus. That thing was money invested like crazy, and
they were going to put a movie out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Warner Brothers couldn't afford not to with that one. And so they had to call in a director in Kubrick, and he came in and he literally on set tore up the script and just went with what they went. And he actually put script together piece by piece, like as they were filming, like the movie was rewritten during filming and
they didn't have the time or the money.
All these other movies we've brought up, all these other huge movies we've brought up had not come out at this point. You know, he's still pretty young in his career, but at that point, the studio has given him enough trust to allow him to do that. That's pretty remarkable considering, once again, we're talking about like directors don't get that kind of privilege today.
No.
They still don't if you have a name like Spielberg or Nolan or those types
of people can demand that kind of control,
but still it's going to, you know, it's going to take a lot to keep that movie project.
Yeah, it takes several, you know, $150-200 million films on your slate to be able to say, I want to do this my way before somebody's going to, and probably not even everybody, but somebody will say, all right, I'll give it to you. I'll let you go ahead and do that.
And not only that, nowadays they make their own public or their own.
They make their own production company.
Yeah, production.
So do it their own way. Right.
Yep, exactly. Well, and according to Kubrick himself, after the debacle associated with creating Spartacus, he demanded total control of every film made after that.
Oh, and he got it.
Yep.
And people were willing to give it to him. Yeah, totally.
We'll build you your own little soundstage. It's all yours. No one else will use it. You can do what you want to do.
But that wasn't the end of the controversy for Kubrick, because, of course, there was A Clockwork Orange.
Oh.
Which is... Am I correct in saying this? Still banned in some countries to this day?
Yeah, it is.
It is.
What did they release it in the UK finally? Because I know it
here just in the past decade,
right? Because I mean, they wouldn't show it there, and I mean that's where the movies.
Well, he was part of the reason it wasn't no longer shown in the UK. He requested it to be pulled after some of the copycat crimes had happened.
Oh, geez.
He was a part of that. But that was a movie that definitely, you want to talk about maybe another trend when we've brought up all these Kubrick movies is pushing boundaries, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Whether they're of special effects or, you know,
habitual line boundary,
anything like that. Yes. So Clockwork Orange, gosh. I remember the first time watching
them.
Yeah, I remember the and not only that too, because you want it. Like every time I see his name, I'm like, oh, this has got to be great because he was phenomenal in Clockwork Orange.
Yeah,
and you watch Caligula and he's walking by having a conversation while somebody, while speaking of Eyes Wide Shut's going on in the background. So,
right.
Like, I mean, he's made some questionable decisions since then. We'll just put it that way. But he definitely was phenomenal in that. But I just like, I guess the theme of the night is the, you know, the feelings that you get from watching movies in 2001 as well, but
yes.
A Clockwork Orange, like I still, every time I still watch that movie, you brought up Aronofsky.
Mm-hmm.
After you watch a couple of after you watch any of Aronofsky's films, you sit there with that feelings just sitting, like you can't do anything afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, no. You're drained.
And that's
for sure.
A few Kubrick movies can definitely do that, but A Clockwork Orange, I think, does that to me more than any other movie.
Oh, totally. Well, it changes the way that I feel about violence and violent people and what should be done in terms of, you know, correcting, as we see it, the behavior of violent people or fringe individuals. It changes the way that you feel about social justice, I feel like. I mean, the way that it ends. The way that they sort of rob him of who he is.
Mm-hmm.
It's
rob him of being able to be anybody.
Right.
It's that it definitely plays with that line, that gray area of, like you said, like how do we form people to be better people at the same time allow us to be individuals? Like where's the control come in? Where's the line? Where does, you know, what is acceptable? Who's to say what is right? Things like that are all put to question in that movie. And everybody's going to come out probably with a different answer on what is right with that. And that's powerful.
Oh,
cinema.
Yeah. There's going to be people that come out and say, we got what you deserved.
Mm-hmm.
And are just totally okay with what happened. And there's going to be people who say, you know, no way should that ever be okay.
Right.
And, I mean, yeah. Well,
It's
so
still a relevant issue, too, because there are still these conversion behavioral modification therapies that are used to deal with what we see as deviations in sexual orientation. And there are people, I've met people that are dealing with the issues that behavioral modifications had to their sexual orientation when they went to some sort of scared straight type of program.
It's not even always scared straight programs now, pilling the eyes open and stuff like that. It now comes in the form of a nice little pill many a time. So,
oh yeah. It's way more socially acceptable than what they did to him. Right.
Yeah. So it's those things, we hide it now medically, but, we'll shift gears before we get too political and stuff on that. But, something I know that both of y'all really want to talk about, because I know one of the topics we discussed a little bit would have been the horror genre, but The Shining. So, do you remember the first time you saw that movie? No?
I'd be honest, a lot of the first times I saw a lot of these movies was with my mom. She really likes movies. Just from an enjoyment standpoint, she probably doesn't get as into it as we do. But, yeah, I mean, I remember watching it. And that kind of opening scene where, you know, it's the weird music, like piano organ type music in the background, and you're flying behind the beetle up the mountain pass for Jack to go do the interview. And it's, oh, man, it's I don't know why, but it's creepy.
It's ominous.
Like everything about that whole movie is just creepy.
Well, the
creepy.
The long, like, distant sequences that just make you feel like you're alone.
Yeah.
In that movie. And that's what it does. That scene, even though you're following a car with a family in it, you feel alone in that scene. Because it's painting the picture of them being alone, you know?
Right.
And then when you're in those long hallways with nobody else there, or when you go into the bar by yourself, just with Jack Nicholson, like it's you're alone, and it just gives you that I'm on no matter who's sitting next to me in the theater, the couch, whatever I'm watching this, it just makes you feel alone and vulnerable. And that's something not a lot of, like, I, as you know, we discussed this a lot. I'm not a big fan of horror movies because not many of them can provoke that feeling. Like, I'm not going to lose sleep tonight because I think some doll is going to wake up in my daughter's room and come stab me, or some leprechaun is going to, you know, that type of stuff doesn't scare me. That's not going to happen.
I'm going to lose sleep now because I'm going to wake up in your daughter's room and come stab you. Yeah.
Well, you're not sleeping here. So
I'm worried for you, buddy.
But the idea of just being stranded at that and losing your mind, like, mm-hmm. that's a realistic, like, that's that's a fear that can make you lose sleep at night.
Yeah.
Especially the fact, I love, unfortunately she can't be here, but Aaron, they stayed at that hotel. They'd go there every Easter at that hotel.
Right.
And they were actually, it wasn't that one. I'm sorry. It was the one for the remake of the TV show. But mm-hmm. knowing that it was The Shining, or I say TV show, miniseries, but knowing that it was The Shining and already knowing the movie that was involved changed the way she felt about staying there afterwards. just because
I could see that
it was so different, but definitely eerie movie and creepy for sure.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw just a scene from that film. So I was very, very young, and I was watching Twister for the first time. Do you guys remember this? That a scene from The Shining was playing at the drive-in film.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
during Twister, and it was the scene with the twins.
Yeah, Danny riding the trike, his big wheel.
Yep,
turning in a corner.
That's
and then,
one of the
bam,
iconic scenes.
Right there.
Yeah, which if I remember correctly, and I hate that this is being recorded, and now I'm going to be held up to like a higher standard. If I remember correctly, that was not in the book. Like, a scene where Danny confronted the twins was not in the book.
I honestly couldn't tell you.
I haven't finished that book yet. I'm reading it right now.
No, I don't remember that from the book.
You're already losing sleep at night then.
There were a lot of changes.
Yeah, he made a lot of significant changes to the book, like adding the maze.
Mm-hmm.
That
mm-hmm.
was a significant change, and taking out the moving topiaries. And I think that was huge for creating how creepy and eerie the film was without sort of crossing the line into cheesy.
Or too much supernatural.
Overly supernatural.
Yeah. Or, yeah,
right,
too much
right.
supernatural stuff. Right. It made it real. It made it a really terrifying prospect.
The TV miniseries, ABC made it.
It's quiet right now because Bob's giving us a rundown on the
Steven Weber.
On the miniseries.
Yes, the TV miniseries, when it came out, they actually used they took the maze out. It actually was more
closer to the book.
Closer to the book,
and they really pushed that as a selling point too.
Right.
This will be a different experience than what you got from the movie.
Faithful
That's what they wanted. Right.
What they were saying. I remember them plugging that as the faithful adaptation, and people being like, oh well, it's more in line with the book and stuff, you know, because everybody wanted to love the new miniseries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talk about the twins. There's one of the cosplayers, and she'll be at Rocky Mountain Con while we're there as well. Leanna Vantress. She recently did a very simple twin cosplay with another cosplayer, and she has a short video clip on all her social media pages where they actually ride up the escalators.
Oh no!
So they just arrive closer to you. But even better is that somebody took that and edited it and just skipped a clip, so they're all of a sudden they're like, you know, a third of the way up, and then all of a sudden they're two-thirds
creepy.
Of the way up.
Oh,
and
no.
Terrifying.
And then they speak, you know, and it's like, oh my goodness, is this the creepiest thing ever? So it's really, and they're holding hands and just coming up with just the straight look on their face.
So
the way it is.
Creepy.
So, which is awkward because Leanna Vantress is not known for being scary. She's known more on the other side of the realm, but Bob's got 2 cents.
Oh, I was just going to say, with The Shining, last year there was a documentary that came out called Room 237.
Yes, very good.
Fascinating.
Very, very good.
I tell you, it's really interesting to watch because it takes opinions of, like, I think there's like 8 or 10 people, and different things in the Shining, they kind of look at it, you know, he was meaning this. Like, there's several, you know, images of Indians and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing this because for the injustices being done to the American Indian.
Right,
so,
right. In reference to the genocide.
Right.
Of the American Indian.
But there's a lot. It's a really interesting documentary if you get the chance to ever see it.
Yeah, watch The Shining, watch the documentary, watch The Shining again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really gives you some interesting ideas.
Well, and there are some really clever things that he did that they highlighted in the documentary that I think contribute to the feeling that something is off or strange for the entire film. So there are a lot of physical impossibilities in the way that the hotel is set up. Lots of rooms that are impossible. Mm. Lots of windows that are impossible. That I think that he did that in a really clever way that when you're watching it, you don't know exactly what it is that makes it feel not right, but it does evoke an emotion that something is not right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what he wanted.
Now,
it's such a clever way of doing it.
For those of you that are big fans of the carpet, there are now, and actually in partnership with Mondo, I guess, is in partnership with it. I can't remember the clothing partner they went with, but you can get a scarf, a sweater, a rug, all that in that pattern.
That's amazing.
A pricey penny, unfortunately, but they are still
it's
awesome.
Not cheap, but it does. They look really good.
The button up. What do you call them? Sweaters.
Yeah, like cardigan.
Yeah, the cardigans. Like, yeah,
that sounds awesome.
Need me one of those for sure. But no, so it's definitely, we're talking about all these things that have become iconic.
Yep.
But that goes back to his other movies, talking about things that have become iconic. 2001, you could go down the list and name as many things that are as iconic for that movie as The Shining. Spartacus, A Clockwork Orange, even Eyes Wide Shut, that was not as widely seen and accepted. There are iconic, I don't feel like there was that many masquerade mask things going on before that as well. Like, I mean, that really brought the masquerade masks back and stuff.
The black capes and stuff. They became a symbol of something more than what they were after
money,
that film.
Yeah, I mean, it was immediately associated with, oh, this is what rich people do.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, rich people wear black capes and masquerade masks and have orgies. So, I mean,
that's a sign of affluence.
You do these things.
Oh, to be rich. So, I did run us off The Shining. There was one thing I wanted to say before I forgot. We were talking about seeing it with your mom, and that's the first time I saw it too, which is always funny because my mom limited so many movies I was allowed to see, and I would always see them with my dad, and she would flip out on them. But at the same time, we're watching The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas or Pretty Woman or The Shining, because these are movies she really loved too, because they were just really good movies. So I remember since she loved it, and I made a reference to this when we were talking favorite movies, I can't give her too much crap because I have sat Orion down to watch The Matrix with me, a rated R action flick, because it is that. So she allowed us to watch this. So I do remember that. And weird enough, I slept through that night somehow, but I'm pretty sure my siblings didn't. So anyways, but I did want to, before we close, to talk a little bit more about AI being his last project. So AI was supposed to be he was going to retire after that too. That was going to be his last film.
Yeah.
And he wrote it. I mean, it was completely written by him. He had started pre-production, and were they going into production already when he passed away? So they were somewhere early in that. And then, of course, like we said, Steven Spielberg took it over. You can really see, though, like I said, that tension, whether you talk about they tug or they collide. However, there's just that tension there. Just doesn't make it sit right. And that's something, though, because when I think about the idea of the movie, the story, everything like that, I wanted it to be all of Kubrick's. Like, I want it to be all of
his
film.
I want to see that movie done by him. I want to see his vision of what that movie actually looks like, because I bet
Well, that's the other thing,
too. I bet it's so different than what actually hit the theaters.
He was notorious for not sharing the endings of the films with the people in them. He was notorious for never connecting the dots during production. Like, we're not doing this scene because of this and this. This scene stands on its own, and hopefully y'all read what of the script you were allowed to have.
Right.
And he was also very well known for not even watching his completed works. He supposedly, I know he saw Clockwork Orange because of all the drama and stuff like that, but it's my understanding, I think that might have been the only movie he actually watched in its entirety after it was completed.
One of the things I had heard is that he would take literally hundreds of takes of a very simple scene. He was just that.
We go back to The Shining. Is my understanding, because there was the parents complained about their kid going down the hallway on that bicycle so many times because they recorded that scene over and over and over again until you just got, because you're working with kids, you got to get those expressions exactly how you want it. So
the way he shoots his movies is what strikes me. And there's the one scene in The Shining that, the iconic scene where Jack sticks his head through the through the hole that he's chopped in the door. But when he's chopping the hole in the door, the camera is focused right on him. So you've got this side view of him. And then as he pulls the axe back, the camera moves back with it. And then when he swings it forward, the camera swings forward with him. And then it pulls it back. But it's not like panning. It's like physically moving back and forth. So you get this unbelievable sense of motion and the power behind those strokes. And it's just, and it's another one of those things. You're just, okay, I get he's chopping through the door, but we just keep doing it. Like, I mean, there's that, oh, why is this going? Just get through the door already. Like in any other horror movie, they're through the door in like two chops. But that wouldn't be how it would work. It would take you a bunch of chops to get through a good solid wood door like he was trying to get through. And so you get this sense of motion and power, and I think, oh, it's that's probably my favorite scene in that movie.
So, so to close, we all picked our gut feeling favorite Kubrick movie. So we're gonna go back around and close. So, Laura, are we still with Eyes Wide Shut now that we've talked about all these films?
It's gotta be. I don't know. I mean, I feel like The Shining is a very close second because I totally adore it, but I can't remove the way that Eyes Wide Shut made me feel. With it being, I mean, it's the first Stanley Kubrick film I'd ever seen, so I feel like it gets an unfair advantage because I experienced something that I'd never experienced before as a movie goer, as a movie watcher, and he delivers that in every single one of his films. So, I mean, I don't think there's a bad choice you can make here, but for mine, it's still Eyes Wide Shut.
Adam, 2001 still?
It should be The Shining. You should change it to The Shining. I feel like we're remiss if nobody picks The Shining.
I'm not picking The Shining. If I were to change it, it would very possibly be for Clockwork Orange. Just because I read that book. I watched that movie and I was like, what the heck did I just see? And again, my mom was like, oh, yeah, it's based on a book. She also reads a lot. And so I was like, all right, so I'm going to pick this book up. You know, I was already a teenager by this point in time. So I was like, I'm going to pick this book up and try and read it. And it's all written in like the English slang, and it's so tough.
Oh yeah.
But so I think it's still 2001 though, but if it weren't going to be 2001, it would be Clockwork Orange.
All right. Well, this game wasn't as fun as I thought it'd be because we all kind of stuck with what we originally said. I would stay with Dr. Strangelove, but then again, you know, since we are picking that
runner up,
almost would be it. I don't know if I can pick just one though. Like, cause if I had to pick just one, maybe a Clockwork Orange, but I feel like, right behind it. It's like when you're crossing that, it's like a horse race. Because you know there's that.
Oh, they're all right there.
There's like 9 times out of 10 you watch a horse race, there's like 6 horses just right there, and they like have to show you the photo to show you came in first, second, and third and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, so it's where I kind of feel like it is. And then you have like that one horse way back there in the back, but it's still making great time.
You
like,
you know, he wins any other race.
There's the AI horse way back there, you know? So, I don't know, 2001, maybe Clockwork Orange fighting for that first place. They, you know, they would finish and show, or whatever you call second and third there, place and show.
Win, place and show.
Yeah, there you go. So, that's the, you know, wrapping it up. So just like we talked about the last episode, we want to hear from you again on the blog, on our Podbean page. If we share it on social media, even if we don't, just let us know, what is your favorite Stanley Kubrick movie? What's your favorite Stanley Kubrick fact? And why do you love Stanley Kubrick? I guess maybe a combination of those elements or something altogether different.
If somebody's out there and you don't like Stanley Kubrick,
let us know, though, because I want to
tell us. Right.
Yeah,
I'm curious as to where that comes from. Yeah. Right.
So this has been a love letter Stanley Kubrick.
We want to know how much medication you've been on for a long time. But, anyways, so Iggy here with our guests. Like I said, we have future episodes coming up with Billy and Brandon from Billy and Brandon Watch Movies, Deddy Cosplay, Griffin Cosplay, many others from the Nerdcast and Project Nerd team. So another episode of Movie Night with Project Nerd has come to a conclusion. Aww. And as Bob decided, our official close is, that's a wrap.